law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swingman. You can shoot the three.
This is why you don't teach lessons.
Exactly. UF basketball fans are terrible and shameful. Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Tuesday, March 31st, 2009, my birthday. I am Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer, and joining me today are...
Evan Drexler, sports editor and football beat writer.
Let's all wish a happy birthday to Adam before we get into this petty introduction.
Happy birthday, Adam.
Thank you. Another year on this earth. Congrats.
That's
quite an accomplishment. I'm Kyle Mainstreet, baseball beat writer.
Basketball beat writer, Mike DiFerdinando.
All right, we got a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk a little bit about Nick Calathes and the statement he just released. We're going to talk about the baseball team, the softball team, a little bit of big picture NCAA basketball stuff from Kyle here. But let's start off with the big news of the day. Deeper, tell us about Nick Calathes.
Yeah, Nick Calathes released a statement a few hours ago saying that he would be putting his name into the NBA draft coming up here in a couple months. He is not going to sign an agent, so if he does not like where he's drafted or his draft projections, he's free to come back to Florida for his junior season.
All right, so what do we all think about this? Is this the right move, you know, declaring but a little bit non-committal, he can still come back if he wants to?
Yeah, this is absolutely the right move for him. I mean, not signing with an agent right away, so he can test the waters and see where he's going to land. It gives him full range to do whatever he wants once he sees his projection. So, I mean, there was no obligation for him to stay at Florida, and there's no obligation to go to the NBA. He can do what he wants, so this is exactly what he should be doing.
I fully expect him to be back in Gainesville next year after he kind of tests the waters here. But, yeah, this move can't hurt him at all. There's nothing that can happen that's going to hurt him here. As long as he doesn't sign with an agent, he's still keeping his options open, and he's going about it the right way.
This is the right move, in my opinion, too. Maurice Spates did a similar thing last year. He did not sign with an agent right away. When it looked like he was definitely going to be a first-round pick, he did sign, and obviously he got drafted by the Sixers. So maybe a little different situation with Nick. He was projected to be a late first-round pick earlier this season, had a kind of rough end of the year, so his draft stock's fallen quite a bit here. Well, it'll be interesting to see where he kind of lands in the coming weeks.
Yeah, it's worth noting that in the latest predictions we've seen, he's not even on the draft board. He's not, you know, predicted to go in the first or second round. Do we feel that's right, and do we feel that rises once, you know, people start seeing him in maybe some workouts?
I think there's no way he doesn't get drafted. I think he'd be a great second-round pick. I think that's bad for him, so if that's going to be the case, he probably should come back. But I think there's no way he gets past the second round.
I'm not really sure where NBA teams would take him this year because the point guard class is so deep. You have so many players that are going to come out. You have Collison. You have Sharon Collins that's probably going to come out. You have Teague. You have Patty Mills. You have Ty Lawson. Mm. All these names are definitely coming out or probably coming out. Steph Curry's going to be a point guard at the next level. So I don't think that he would get drafted actually this year. And if he did, it would be at the very end, like Chris Richard type territory there. And, or even Torian Green, who actually went after him. But I can't possibly explain why his draft stock has fallen so much. It's a little baffling to me because I feel like he had a very good year this season. Like, watching him play pretty much every single game this year, I thought he showcased a lot of his talents. He's a big guard, which they like at the next level. He can see over the defense, make every pass on the court. He's a really effective scorer. He's unselfish. He can rebound the ball. He's a little bit, maybe not the best defender, and it's going to be hard for him to guard point guards. He may have to learn to guard shooting guards at the next level, which I don't know if he's athletic enough to do. But that's the only really hole I see in his game right now.
Well, it had to have something to do with his sort of collapse in the SEC tournament, right? Does anybody think that that impacted it at all?
Just late season in general, he wasn't playing his best basketball in the SEC tournament and late in SEC play, and that has to have affected his stock. And the big thing with the second round is that he doesn't get guaranteed money if he goes in the second round. So I think there's no way he's going in the first round this year. And so he's going to have to wind up coming back to Gainesville.
The draft isn't about results in college. Nobody drafts on like what kind of success you had in college. It doesn't mean anything. It's all about potential. It's all about projections. It's all about athleticism and what you can be as an NBA player. You see, you know, mid-major guys get taken in the first round every year. Not often, but, you know, you get a guy like Courtney Lee or Jason Thompson, who they didn't, you know, go on to win NCAA tournaments or carry their teams on their back, but they're solid projections to the next level. So I really don't think it was the end of the year. I think it's just the sheer amount of point guards that seem to be coming out right now and where they feel he stacks up with them.
Yeah, and Kyle's right. Billy Donovan talked about this actually after the last NIT game, and people were asking questions about Nick and stuff. And he said, you know, it's not really about whether or not Nick's ready. It's about whether or not people think he will be ready in the future. And if he's projected to be someone the NBA is interested in, it's worth his while to go because of the guaranteed money. If he's a first-round pick, he'll get, what, 3 years guaranteed money and an option on a fourth, so you can't really turn that down. Like, they give you room to develop. I think maybe there's a chance that he could develop more in the NBA than he could by coming back to Florida.
I was going
to
go with that. Where do we think he fits as an NBA player? You know, he's a tall point guard. Like you said, Kyle, he's a little slow. I mean, he's a point guard at the next level, but he's obviously not matching up against them. Where does he go? You know, where does he fit on an NBA roster?
I think he's absolutely a point guard.
Yeah, he will definitely be a point guard at the next level. He's exactly what you want. He compares pretty favorably to Jason Kidd, except without the defense, and a better shooter. But you're going to have to pair him with a guard, a two guard, who can guard both guard positions so that on either night, you know, on any night, you can switch him up and put him whoever the weaker guard's on to defend, because he's really going to have some problems probably defending at the next level. So you're going to need a team with a good concept of team defense. I think like maybe the Rockets would be a really good fit for him. Aaron Brooks has played great for them lately, though, so I don't know if they would be interested. But I think a team like that who plays really good team defense, who could make up for him a little bit, and then he could spark them on offense, would be a good fit for him.
All right, and you have a little bit of stuff about Calathes more in the big picture, a little bit of news about the All-Americans being released today as well, right?
Yeah, the All-American teams came out today. Nick Calathes' name was nowhere to be found, which I was a little bit surprised about. I don't know, there are big-name guys on these lists, but I'll give you guys the first team first, and that's Blake Griffin of Oklahoma, Tyler Hansbrough, UNC, James Harden of Arizona State, Steph Curry of Davidson, and DeJuan Blair of Pitt. I felt very good about that first team. I thought that was pretty much the winning.
And Griffin won Player of the Year award too, correct?
Yes, Blake Griffin was Player of the Year, which again, pretty much unquestioned that was going to happen.
Yeah.
So the second teams were then made up of Hashim Thabeet, Ty Lawson, Luke Harangody, Jody Meeks, and Jarrell McNeil of Marquette. And the third team was Terrence Williams of Louisville, Tony Douglas of FSU, Sam Young of Pitt, Sharon Collins of Kansas, and Gerald Henderson of Duke. So of that list, are there any guys that you guys are surprised about or that you do like, thought should be higher?
I sensed a little bit of surprise in your voice about Jody Meeks making the second team.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised he made the second team, although I did think he had a good year. I maybe would have put him on the third team, but I thought he had a good enough year to at least be in consideration.
I'm a little bit surprised by Jody Meeks. He had a good year. I think the one really big game against Tennessee was kind of, you know, the showcase for him, kind of carried him a little bit in people's minds. But I think maybe third team would have been better for Jody.
I'd agree. That was the one that really surprised me when you read it off there. Jody Meeks on the second team. Third team, sure, because he was a really prolific scorer. But I just don't see him as a second team All-American.
Who would you put in the second team ahead of him?
From the second team, I would probably go with Terrence Williams if I had to pick one of the guys to move up. I don't know how you get what you guys think about it. I'd say Terrence Williams. But, okay, I've made a list. We're going to play a fun little game here with our three panelists. I'm going to play the role of moderator for once, Adam, so you get to offer up some opinion here. I have a list of 8 guys here and their statistics from the season, okay? 4 of them are either on the second or third team currently, and 4 of them were left off for reasons that we'll discuss afterwards. But I've set up a bracket. I ranked them just on my own because it's not really important where they're ranked. And I'm going to give you guys matchups. We're going to advance them, and we're going to see who we ended up with at the end as far as statistics. So we're going to do kind of like the NCAA tournament where they give you the resume of the teams and not the names.
So this is based entirely on statistics.
Entirely on statistics. So we'll get to that
discussion. The name and the win-loss, none of that has anything to do with this.
Well, we'll get to that discussion afterwards, probably after we end up with, you know, certain players. But yes, this portion is going to be just on statistics.
Okay.
All right, so the first is the 1-8 matchup. The one seed comes in at 27.5 points a game, which is second in the nation, 8 rebounds, 4 assists, just over 2 steals, and they're shooting 45% from the field, 88% from the line, and 35% from 3. I know that's a lot of numbers. Just try to pick ones you like, I guess. And the 8 seed comes in 16.5 points per game, 5 rebounds, 2.5 assists, 45%, 76%, and 34% from 3. So let's go around and pick the 1 of the 8 seed here, and we'll advance one.
I mean, 1's better at every statistic.
Yeah, 1's the
clutch. Unquestionably.
All right, so
number
go.
1 seed for a reason, right?
Yeah. This is the Pitt ETSU.
Yeah, exactly.
ETSU gave him a run, though. I don't know. This guy didn't give number 1 a run.
So we'll go to the 2-7 matchup now. Number 2 has 17.2 points a game, 5.3 rebounds, 6.5 assists, and 2 steals a game. And they're shooting 48% from the field, 71% from the line, 39% from 3. I should mention all these guys shoot threes with fair regularity, so it's a good estimate to have them. They're all guards, pretty much.
Okay.
The 7 seed is 19 points, 3 rebounds, 5 assists, 43 from the field, 80 from the line, 38 from deep. So, again, let's go around. Which one you guys want to advance here?
Well, I want to put number 2.
Okay.
But
I'm also going to advance the 2 seed.
Yeah, this one's a lot closer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of free throw shooting being important for a team. I like the 80 to 71, but and the 19 points. Over, I'll give 7. I'll pick 7 in the upset.
Ooh. Okay, we're still going to advance 2 based on majority here, but
that's understandable.
Noted that you had 7.
That 7 was close. This is much
closer than the last
8.
One. I agree. Well, it got hard to rank them, so part of this could be me, the committee, getting this wrong. But
committee okay. Always gets something wrong.
So we've advanced the 1 and the 2 seeds. Now we'll go to the 4-5 game, which will play the 1 seed next.
What about the 3-6?
You want to do 3-6 first?
Doesn't matter.
Well,
I think we were going in order.
Since
all.
You're not passionate, I'm going to go 4-5, which will play the 1 seed in the second round.
Okay.
So the number 4 seed comes in 23.7 points a game, 3.4 rebounds, 1.8 assists. Their shooting percentages are great, 46, 90, and 40.
Wow.
Yeah. A great shooter, you could say.
So why was this person not above the 2 seed?
I mean,
I guess
just
the rebounds
points,
and assists.
Right?
Okay.
This is a team concept here.
Okay.
All right. So the 5 seed comes in 21.5 points a game, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, shooting 45, 81, and 39.
All right, deeper.
I'm going to go with the 5. I think it's more balanced.
More balance, so you like a couple more assists?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree that I like the assists, but the shooting percentages of 4. I mean, 90% free throw, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I'm going to advance the 4.
Okay.
Evan?
I don't know. This is even tougher than the 2-7. I'm going to
really?
Go 5.
I feel this is way easier.
I'm going to go 5.
Oh, wow. Well, I
are you
in fairness, I think I know who these people are.
Okay,
so
that's cool. If you
think
you know.
You would have gone with 4.
I absolutely would have went 4, no
okay.
question. But this is a democracy, and I'm the moderator, so we're advancing the 5, all right? I'm not going to pull a Mike McCall. My opinion's no more important than the 3 of yours combined. So, all right, let's do 3-6 now. Number 3 comes in at 23 points a game, 3 rebounds, 6 assists. Also a good shooter, 46, 84 from the line, and 43 from 3. The 6 seed is coming in 11 points a game, 2.5 rebounds, 7.5 assists, which is second in the nation, and they're shooting 40, 71, and 34.
Deeper, you want to lead us off?
It's got to be 3. 11 points isn't doing it. 7 assists is impressive. But
7.5 assists.
I mean, that's impressive,
yeah.
But it's not as complete as
right.
number 3.
I agree. The assist thing sort of made me react there. But much like President Obama, I'm going to go chalk here.
Mm-hmm.
3.
And it is also the 3 seed for me.
Okay.
This is unanimous.
That was an easy one. So 3 moves on to play 2. And 1 and 5 after 5 pulled the upset. So again, I'll run through the statistics really quick for the 1-5. You got 1 seed, 27.5 points a game, 8 rebounds, 4.2 assists, 2.3 steals. Percentages are 45, 88, 35. And the 5 seed, 21.5 points a game, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. Percentages are 45, 81, and 39. Let's go around here.
I'm going to go number 1, I think.
Number 1?
I'll agree. I think 1 is a little bit
impressive. Huh?
Yeah.
I agree.
I also think 1.
Okay, so 1 seed advances into the finals where they'll meet the 2-3 winner. So let's go 2 real quick. Just over 17 points, just over 5 rebounds, 6.5 assists, 2 steals. Percentages 48, 71, 39. And then the number 3 seed, 23 points, 3 rebounds, 6 assists. Percentages are 46, 84, 43. I think this is a close matchup. So let's
yeah.
see what you guys have to say.
I'm going to go 3.
You're going to go 3. Okay.
I'm actually going to go 3 as well. I like the shooting percentages and more points per game. The rebounds aren't there and the assists are slightly behind, but I'm going to go with 3.
Okay.
Yeah, the free throw shooting and 3-point shooting really does it for me for the 3 over the 2 in this one.
Okay, so you're going to put 3 through. So we have 1 versus 3 matchup. If you were picking between number 2 and number 5 for like the third place, who would you guys go with? I'm not going to read the stats again, but 2 and 5. Who we go if they play the consolation match here?
I'm going to go 2, but only because I think I know who 2 is.
Okay. Wow, that's not what I want from you. That defeats the whole purpose
but
of
I
this.
Think this player is deserving.
Okay,
so.
Okay. That's more like it.
You're going to be completely wrong. That's not at all.
I might go with the 5, actually.
You're going to go 5?
I'll go with 2.
Okay, so Tears is the third place winner, and we'll get to that afterwards. All right, now the finals, the matchup you've all been waiting for here.
Since you first heard it existed 10 minutes ago.
The mystery men that are playing in this matchup.
The one seed, once again, almost 28 a game, 8 boards, 4.2 assists, just over 2 steals, 45, 88, 35. And number 3, 23 points, 3 assists, or I'm sorry, 3 rebounds, 6 assists. 46 from the field, 84 from the line, 43 from deep. Who do we like here, guys?
28 and 8 is so impressive. It's got to be number one.
Okay.
I'll agree. I mean, the three-point shooting isn't nearly as impressive as, you know, 43 or 45 or whatever else has been in here, but 28 and 8's definitely the winner.
Yeah, the committee did a good job selecting its number one overall seed for this tournament, and the number one overall seed is the winner.
All right. So now we've done our blind experiment here, or at least we think so. Deeper's got a little bit of knowledge. He was the basketball writer, so he thinks he knows some guys. So go ahead, tell me who you thought you knew heading into the experiment here.
I think number two is Calathes.
Number two is, in fact, Nick Calathes. Sure. He's right about that.
17 a game, but it was fresh in my mind.
And you had another guess?
Is number one Woodside?
No, he's not. But wow. Woodside is in this.
Huh.
Okay. All right, so let's do this. All right, the number one seed who won the whole thing is a guy named Lester Hudson, who I don't know if any of you have heard of, but he plays for Tennessee Martin. He is a senior over there, I believe. He was a junior college transfer into like another small school, Tennessee Martin. He's actually a pro prospect. I don't know if he'll go, but he's got all kinds of game, and he's second in the nation in scoring, and his numbers were just through the roof. So that's our winner, Lester Hudson. Let's be honest here. Have any of you guys heard of Lester Hudson?
I've never heard of Lester Hudson.
Not once.
No clue.
Not once. Okay.
What conference is Tennessee Martin?
I honestly am not sure what conference they're in. We can look that up.
What school did you say?
Tennessee Martin. I believe they're the Seahawks is their mascot.
Seahawks.
Even I don't know.
Now, I know you said earlier that this is, you know, for NBA draft, they're not looking at how the team finished, but how did Tennessee Martin do this season?
I mean, they didn't win their conference,
they
obviously.
Didn't make
they
didn't
win the tournament. Right. They were pretty good within their conference. I forget. It might be like the Southern Conference or the Big South, something like that. But
I couldn't even tell you.
Okay, so we're not really sure. The 3 seed who made it to the finals is Ben Woodside, who Deifer thought was going to be the 1 seed, but he's the guy on North Dakota State who dumped in, what was it, 38 or something like that against Kansas?
Yes, he had quite
ridiculous.
A game.
Yeah. So Ben Woodside was the number 3 seed, okay?
And our second place finisher.
Our second place finisher, correct. Our third place finisher was Nick Calathes, who was the number 2 seed. And the guy you advanced into the semifinals, the 5 seed, was Tony Douglas. And the 4 seed was Jody Meeks that you had him beating in the first round. So you guys moved Tony Douglas in front of Jody Meeks into the next round. I personally would have moved Jody Meeks, but that's okay.
And we really did have no idea who these people are. That Kyle's like, we didn't set this up before, and so there's no SEC bias.
Kyle surprised us with this game.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is out of nowhere.
And then, so the other ones that we didn't get to, we haven't mentioned already. The 6 seed was LaVance Fields. He was the guy with 11 points and 7.5 assists. A big name that a lot of people would expect, but his statistics without a name, maybe not so impressive. He does distribute the ball very well, but his game maybe not so well-rounded. The number 7 seed was Sharon Collins, who is on the third team already, and you had him going out easily to Calathes in the first round, the 2 seeds, so something to keep in mind. And the 8 seed, who we all scoffed at, was Gerald Henderson of Duke, who's also on the 3rd seed and got absolutely murdered by Leslie Hudson in the first round. So
rightfully so, I think.
The thing, and this will lead to more discussion here, but the thing that I was trying to illustrate here, let it be known, Calathes was the biggest big school player that went the farthest that you guys picked out of the big school players.
And also, I'm pretty sure I had Collins over Calathes in the first round.
You did have Collins over Calathes in the first round, yeah. They both did, and I would have voted for Calathes also.
Yes.
So, but you did have Collins over Calathes. So that was the breakdown of everything. Kind of illustrates, I thought Calathes should have been on one of these teams. I think Gerald Henderson making it, his numbers again were 16.5 points, 5 rebounds, 2.5 assists, 45 from the field, 76 from the free throw line, 34 from 3. Unbelievably unimpressive to me. I feel like just because he's from Duke, he got a mention and got thrown on there.
Yeah.
And what do you guys think after doing this? Any thoughts?
The guy that surprised me is LaVance Fields, because his stats are not that great by any means. But if you look at the college basketball season as a whole, he's definitely one of the stars of the season. And he's a guy I probably would have had on a team, for sure.
The thing I'll ask about Fields is, did he really need to score on a team like Pitt? I mean, did he have to be the guy? He obviously had 8 assists a game. I mean, what do you guys think about
that? No, that's a fair point. I mean, obviously his job was to get guys the ball. Down the stretch, he kind of became their go-to scorer. But, yeah, he has guys like first-teamer DeJuan Blair and third-teamer Sam Young on his team who dumped in, you know, almost 20 points a game.
That's my point about
him. This goes back to what Evan said about wins and losses. And Pitt had a great season. He's a big reason why Pitt had a great season. So maybe
so
you should get a little bit of love about that.
Okay, so as a whole, do we think that small school players should get outweighed by big school players? And does your team success dictate where you rank sometimes? Evan, let's get your take on that.
I think sometimes, like personally, the team success certainly will rank into something if I was making the selections for an All-American team. I mean, we just did a thing looking at only numbers and no names, and it was clear that the smaller schools people, but you're just throwing up stats there.
Mm-hmm.
And when a selection committee is going to take things into account, it certainly will take into account the name Duke like it did for Henderson,
right,
making the third team.
I'll agree with that. I think team success really factors in there. But what would have been interesting to me is if we'd gotten all these stats and then gotten the team win-loss record to see if that would have affected us at all. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know.
Right, well, I think that the stats here, like some of these small school kids put up big stats, but you have to wonder about the competition they're putting up against. So, like, I don't know if this kid from Tennessee Martin is going to put up the same numbers that he's playing at Duke in the ACC.
Well, I'm glad you all said that because I've trapped you into another point yet again. we all had no qualms whatsoever with the first team, but our boy Steph Curry, America's sweetheart, ends up on the first team. He's the nation's leading scorer, but he can't get his team into the tournament. They don't even win their conference tournament. And he plays against scrubs for the duration, for the most of their schedule. So is it fair that Steph Curry, somebody we've fallen in love with in the past, gets to be on the first team when essentially Ben Woodside's putting up similar stats and got his team into the tournament?
I almost said something about Curry on the first team when we were talking about who we had problems with, because Curry, as great as he is, I think gets a lot of publicity for last season's success and not so much this season. He really gets a lot of favorable press for that.
Well, I love Steph Curry and can't possibly look at this objectively. So. I will mention, though, his brother Seth was making the right decision going to Duke. He will get all of the publicity that Steph never did at Davidson. So there you go.
I don't agree with that. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, when you put me like that, I'm absolutely wrong. I'm contradicting myself there because I was persuaded by what Steph Curry did in last year's tournament, and mm-hmm. I feel like he rode that success into this season and just, you know, was in the public eye, and now he's on the first team.
Right, and that's a problem I think we all have to look at here. I love Steph Curry just as much as the next guy, one of my favorite players I've ever watched in college basketball, but I don't think it's fair that he gets to be evaluated on a different scale than the other small school players, especially Ben Woodside, who got his team into the tournament and gave Kansas a close one in the first round. So I don't know. I think it's really a tough balance that the people who make these teams have to deal with. But it's kind of like who you want to let in, who don't you. Lester Hudson, none of us have ever heard of him, but he put up great numbers in a small conference.
But Davidson did play a pretty decent non-conference schedule against pretty big schools.
Okay,
so
how many games did they play against pretty big schools?
Three or four.
Right.
How many points did he score against, like, North Carolina and NC State?
How many points did Ben Woodside score in the NCAA tournament against Kansas?
In one game against Kansas. But Steph Curry could do the same thing in a game against Kansas, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think Lester Hudson could, too, or any of these other guys that win the opportunity.
When are these list voted on? Is this before the NCAA tournament?
I honestly can't tell you. I wish I knew that, but
I just want to say, I don't think Nick Calathes could score however many points in a game against Kansas.
Really?
In the NCAA tournament. Yeah, I'm just throwing that out there.
I would agree with that.
I mean, I watched him score 33 against Kentucky.
So after this,
I don't know about
Kentucky
that.
Made the NIT. Like,
after this lengthy exercise, I'm going to read the teams back again by last name only, and we'll get a final opinion on who we thought should have made or who we thought should have been shuffled.
This is going to show what we've learned.
Yeah. So first team, Griffin, Hansbrough, Harden, Curry, Blair. Second team, Thabeet, Lawson, Heron, Godey, Meeks, McNeil. Third team, Terrence Williams, Tony Douglas, Sam Young, Sharon Collins, Gerald Henderson, Defer, what did we learn today?
That Gerald Henderson should not have been on the third team.
And who would you replace him with?
I guess maybe your boy, what's this kid's name?
Lester Hudson?
I don't know. I still like Nick Calathes as someone who's probably one of the best players in the country that should have been on this list. So I'm going to go Nick Calathes, actually.
Where was Collins on?
Collins was a third teamer, yeah.
All right. Well, we had Calathes advancing past him, right?
Right.
And then we had Henderson completely off it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Douglas, who was a third-teamer on here.
Third-teamer.
And Meeks was a
second-teamer.
Second-teamer. So you're
okay.
Switching them.
I would switch the two,
okay.
And I think you put, like, a Calathes in replacement of Henderson.
Okay.
Yeah, get rid of Henderson. Put either Hudson or Woodside on there. I like Woodside's numbers a lot.
Yeah. I if it were me, I would drop Collins and Henderson altogether from the third team. I would put on Woodside and Calathes. I'm going to leave Lester Hudson out, even though he has the best stats, just because we're trying to take into the balance of all the different things. then I'm actually going to drop Steph Curry to the second team.
I'm just going
to
ask
him. And I'm going to move Ty Lawson up. I don't have Ty Lawson's stats in front of me, but his shooting percentages were the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. Don't hold me to this, but I want to say it was 54% from the field, high 80s to 90 from the line, and like 47 from three.
Oh, that's
okay,
stupid.
Not to mention he's scoring almost 17 a game and dishing out over six assists a game and over two steals a game. Like, his stats were just unbelievable. I think Ty Lawson should have been on the first team instead of Steph Curry, who we think may be riding a little bit of the reputation into this first team berth. So that's Professor Kyle's class on the All-American teams, and I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, clearly we've learned a lot here. Hopefully
you got schooled by Professor Kyle.
All right, before we move on there, a quick correction. Tennessee Martin, who, what's his name? Lester Hudson. Who he plays for. They are part of the Ohio Valley Conference, the Skyhawks, not the Seahawks or whatever we said before.
Right.
And their conference was represented by Kyle's favorite, Morehead State. In the NCAA tournament this year.
Right. Probably the most well-known team is Austin Peay from that conference. They've been in the tournament a few years.
Yeah. Morehead State's a pretty well-known team if for name only.
Yeah, I guess so.
Let's grow up a little bit.
All right, let's move on here. We're going to talk a little bit about some UF sports here. Kyle, tell me about what the baseball team did this weekend.
All right, well, the baseball team is quietly on fire here. They swept Alabama at home over the weekend. They won 11-4, 9-8, and 10-7, so they put some runs on the board this weekend. From what I understand from, you know, watching the games and doing a little research, Alabama, not a great pitching team, good hitting team, and they couldn't really keep them off the board. The first two games, Friday and Saturday night games, were come-from-behind affairs. They got down 4-0 after four innings in Friday night's game. Ended up winning 11-4. They were up 5-4 and then busted it open in the eighth. And Jeff Barfield actually started that game. He's been their best starter so far this season, but he struggled and only went just over three innings for them. Then Saturday's game, Nick Morande came out and started, did much of the same, came out, struggled. He only went a little over three innings for them. Alex Pantoliotis came in a game that seemed to be out of hand. They were down 7-0 for most of the game. Then they were down 8-2. And going into the bottom of the ninth, the score was 8-2, and they mounted the most incredible comeback I've ever seen in person at a baseball game. They put seven runs on the board, came back to win 9-8. Absolutely ridiculous rally. None of us thought it was going to happen. I remember complaining to, you know, the other reporters over there, like, oh, this game's been terrible. We've known what's going to happen the whole time. Like, let's just get out of here. And, of course, we got something great.
I was watching the game on the online game tracker on Saturday. I left my apartment to go eat dinner at Dockside. And when I get to Dockside, they shuffle us into one of the back rooms that doesn't have any of the huge TVs. So we can't really see what's going on. Oof. But like gradually we start hearing applause from the majority of people in the restaurant. More applause and more applause and more applause. And this woman that's just on the edge of the room who can kind of see the bigger TV, she jumps out of her seat, screams, they tied it! They tied it! So I guess at that point it was 8-8. And then like 30 seconds later, the applause is deafening inside this restaurant and the Gators came back. So I wasn't there to see it, but I saw it vicariously through the other patrons of the restaurant, and they were pretty darn excited about it, so it must have been crazy.
Yeah, it was ridiculous, and they had no business winning that game, really. Alabama made six errors, including two in the last inning. They really let them back in that game. Preston Tucker was kind of the star of that ninth inning for my money. He led off with a
triple. Don't tell Bobby.
Yeah, he led off with a triple to start the inning. Scored a run, and then later came back up with two outs and two men in scoring position and hit the single that tied the game up. The winning hit was even more ridiculous than anything else that happened. Daniel Piggott comes in. He actually came in the previous inning to pinch hit the eighth, but because they batted around, he got another at bat. And with a guy on third base and two outs, he drops down a bunt down the third baseline, beats it out pretty easily. And they dogpile him at first base, and that was that. It was pretty incredible to watch. So definitely not your run-of-the-mill finish to a baseball game.
I agree. I was actually watching that on Game Tracker, and I got to see the whole thing. I was just at my apartment watching it. I was thinking, like, this has to be delayed or something. Like, there's no way this is correct. This has to have happened before because, like, this is ridiculous. It was 2-8 when I started looking at it, and I check back, and it's like, oh, 4-8. I'm like, this is a game now. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, yeah, that was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was really something I've never seen before. And it was kind of interesting because you had Pantoliotis came into that game from Morande, and he pitched absolutely great, shut them down. He only let up one more run. And you're kind of thinking, like, oh, Pantelios did good today, but it's all for naught. Like, he came in the game was out of hand anyway. Maybe they should have got some of the other guys some work. Mm. And then at the end, it's like, oh, you know, they got the payoff for it. And Ross Wilson, who you guys may know as John Parker Wilson's younger brother and star of Two-A-Days on MTV, hit a home run in that Saturday game over the left field bleachers. He's their number three hitter, actually a really good college baseball player.
I've never heard of him, nor do I watch MTV.
What? You've never heard of Ross Wilson?
I was about this very situation. I was so excited when I heard this.
Yeah.
So, tell me about Ross Wilson's home run.
Well, he struck out. He
like a schoolgirl looking up to like a TV idol.
I
want to
say he was 1-for-5 with 3 strikeouts. I know he had at least 3 strikeouts.
So Riley Cooper is.
Yeah, but I mean, he got up there and like he just cranked one, got a hold of a pitch, and just like the wind was blowing very, very strongly, like to left field, but almost it was almost horizontal, so it was blowing it out of bounds. And he just cranked one, and it kept hooking and hooking, but it stayed barely fair and just cleared the bleachers by a mile. And he ran around, he launched it though, it was a big shot.
And did he carry the John Parker swag? Is what I want to know.
Well, the first at bat that he had, he got rung up looking and gave the umpire all sorts of attitude. So, as you may come to expect from the Wilson clan, I don't know. But I was impressed with him. They held Kent Mathis in check for most of the weekend. He was their big hitter coming in. He had 15 home runs coming into the series, which was tied with the entire UF team, and he only got one off of them. So I'd say that's a success. And, you know, Sunday's game, they went on to win 10-7. They actually didn't have to come from behind in Sunday's game for a change. But Patrick Keating threw for them and did not pitch well yet again. So there's kind of some issues surrounding him right now.
The weather was terrible Friday night and miserable all day Saturday. Did you see any funny fly ball stuff? I know you mentioned that home run.
Saturday was absolutely ridiculous.
It was the windiest I've ever seen Gainesville.
Yeah, it's the windiest I can remember it being anywhere I've been that didn't involve pre- or post-hurricane conditions, which we've had a lot of in Florida. But we were in the press box, and, like, everything was flying around. We couldn't eat because, like, the plates were flipping over because they keep the press box open. And, like, it got to the point where everything had to be, like, weighted down. So we're using our phones as paperweights, and the phones weren't heavy enough. Like, the gust of winds would come in and knock all our stuff over and flip our phones and stuff. We were making jokes that laptops were going to be flying around pretty soon. But yeah, the wind gusts were ridiculous. Preston Tucker's triple in the ninth inning, what seemed to be a routine fly ball, but the wind just got a hold of it, carried it out there, somehow got over the center fielder's head and left center field and went for a triple. Avery Barnes turned a routine fly ball into a double because of the wind in left field for Florida. There were numerous incidents where players were tracking fly balls forever and had to like make running catches on routine balls because the wind was just doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
That just makes the game that much more exciting.
Oh, definitely. It was fun to watch, that's for sure.
Now, the other question I have about this series is, how bad is this team starting pitching right now? Because that seems to be a huge, huge problem.
Well, it's really funny because the starting pitching has been really weak, but whoever's been coming in and throwing the bulk of the innings in relief has been doing a really good job. Clint Franklin's been great for them in long relief. You've had Pantelios come in and kind of save the day. Greg Larson's been good for them in relief. So it's really been a mixed bag of, you know, the starters haven't been good, but the guys coming in, pitching 4 or 5 innings in the middle of the game have done really well for them. But their starting pitching is a huge issue. Steven Locke's going to start the Tuesday night game against FSU, and they need him. They need him to go out there and eat some innings and prove that he can be a good top-of-the-rotation guy, because Keating has just really been awful. Miranda's been inconsistent. Barfield had been great, and he had a rough start, so you really never know what you're going to get from these guys. But despite all that, they've won 9 of their last 10 going into the FSU game.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that. The team is ranked now, right? They're back in the rankings.
Yeah, well, you know, the ranking that we use at the Alligator is the Baseball America poll, so they've been ranked in and out of other polls, but they just climbed back into the Baseball America rankings for the first time in a little over a month, and they're number 20, so, you know, they're 18-8. They've won 9 of their last 10, like I just said, and they swept a couple SEC teams at home. So they've really, you know, they've done a pretty good job lately. And this last series against Alabama, they did a good job not making errors. They didn't shoot themselves in the foot with errors, and that's really kind of what it's coming down to for them.
These last two sweeps in SEC week, and I was there for the Tennessee series the whole time. I was writing for the Knoxville News Sentinel. I was the Tennessee beat writer, but you know, that Tennessee's not a very good team.
Right.
And Alabama, you said, isn't a very good pitching team. They're a decent hitting team. But, I mean, do we know how good this team is based on beating two not very good SEC teams?
Just the fact that they can sweep two not very good SEC teams is, you know, decent at least. Yeah, Tennessee is nothing to be too proud of. They're towards the basement of the SEC. Alabama, I think, was actually a pretty decent sweep for them. Maybe they're probably not a great team. They're maybe finished third in the West or something like that, but at least they got the sweep at home. And that's the other thing, is that at home they've been a little better than they have on the road. They
same way it was last year, too.
Yeah, they haven't had to go on the road much this year so far, but they went into Arkansas, got swept. You know, they haven't been, you know, quite as good, but they've been untested. So I think this neutral site game against FSU on Tuesday is going to be good for them.
Do you know if Arkansas is still undefeated in SEC play?
I do not. Not 100% sure on that.
Because Arkansas, I think, is the top team in the West. And when the Gators go to Georgia, that'll be another huge
well, preseason, I think LSU is picked to win the West. They're very high in the polls right now. I want to say they're second in the Baseball America poll.
Mm-hmm.
And Ole Miss, I know, also has a very good team. So it'll probably be the three of them with Arkansas battling it out in the West. Maybe Alabama finishes fourth then.
LSU was ridiculous last year. They went on a 17-game winning streak and came from behind to win in the first round of the SEC tournament, which was a huge comeback when I saw in Hoover, Alabama. That was amazing. And then they wound up winning the tournament, going to the College World Series. So
yeah, they're definitely loaded again. And the SEC is tough. Georgia's another team I think are ranked in the top 10 in Baseball America. So when they have to start playing some of these teams, you know, we'll know better what they're made of. And the thing that's really been interesting is their series have been sweeps one way or another. Despite going into the ninth inning, I was like, hey, guys, we're going to get a series that's not a sweep, but it didn't end up that way. Because they've swept, you know, a bunch of teams at home. They've swept Tennessee. They've swept Alabama. They swept Duquesne. They swept Louisville. They've swept all these series. And then they've gotten swept by Arkansas. They got swept by Miami at home. But they haven't split any of these three-game series, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what that means.
That's crazy numbers-wise.
Yeah, it's just the odds of that happening is really weird. Maybe there's just a little bit of momentum.
They looked really bad in that Miami and then Arkansas. Those two weekends looked terrible. But then these other weekends, they look like they can hit the crap out of the ball. And
right.
I don't know, just up and down.
Well, the lineup shuffling does not stop for this team. You have Matt Dendecker has cemented himself as a leadoff hitter. He's kind of taken over that role. But the rest of the lineup, it's just who knows what O'Sullivan's going to do on any given day. And that's okay. I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I think it keeps the guys a little bit fresh. It's kind of exciting probably for them to check the lineup card every day, like see where they're hitting.
Yeah,
so.
Is center field and left field and maybe shortstop with Josh Adams, are those the only solidified positions on
defense-wise? Defense? Yeah, those are the only – Buddy Monroe's the everyday catcher now.
I know last year they had three guys.
Right, and they still will use Tigner, and Foster's been playing a little bit of first base. But, yeah, Buddy Monroe is definitely the everyday catcher. So I'd say those four positions are solidified. And then you've had players. Pisani plays pretty much every day, but you don't know if he's going to play second or third. Riley Cooper plays a lot in right field. But, you know, occasionally Tyler Thompson. Daniel Piggott's been getting a lot of playing time now.
Jonathan Piggott, does he still play it on right field?
Jonathan Piggott, he got a start the other day. But, no, Daniel Piggott's been playing much more than him. And Daniel Piggott's shown a lot more pop at the plate. So I think he's the better Piggott at this point for the team and has kind of supplanted his brother.
I wanted to ask about that because I saw on your live blog of it, which game was it? Jonathan Piggott started, right? And you thought maybe he accidentally put Jonathan Piggott he was supposed to
put I made the joke that O'Sullivan just got confused and Jonathan Piggott ended up out there because their numbers are similar. Daniel Piggott's eight. Yeah, and Jonathan Piggott's nine. But, you know, Jonathan Piggott after the game, he's really excited for his brother, got the game when he hit, and it's kind of cool to see. It was like a... I don't know, a small sport feel, you know. I don't think you get something like that in football where you get a guy come off the field and he's like just all really pumped up for his brother who's on the team and they got a big win and stuff like that. So it was cool.
All right.
Daniel Piggott's introduction music is far better than Jonathan Piggott's too. Daniel Piggott has some sweet like metal guitar riff. I don't know what the heck song it's from, but and whatever Piggott has can't beat whatever Jonathan Piggott has can't possibly.
Jonathan
beat
Piggott's
that.
Got some rap. I can't remember
yeah,
what it
so
is.
Obviously,
it's
so obviously Daniel
rap.
Piggott is superior to any rap music that Jonathan walks out to.
Right, now
oh, and Preston Tucker, let's talk about him. He was named SEC Freshman of... Sorry.
We'll get out of here eventually.
Yeah, he was named SEC Freshman of the Week. That's all I want to say. He had a great last five games. Hit 500 over the course of the week. Still hasn't provided the power that me and Bobby thought he would, but he's hitting for extra bases, just not the home runs. But he's doing a good job ever since he kind of took some time off to adjust his swing or whatever coach was doing with him there. But MacArthur's kind of fallen off, too. I don't know. He's looked like he's a little bit injured, honestly, and maybe a little bit broken down. I know he had some hamstring issues. So and Mooney hurt his foot the other day, so he could be out for about a week here. But you never really know when you show up to the baseball stadium what lineup you're going to see. So,
all right, are we good now?
We're good. You have the floor.
Adam and Mike DeFerdinando over here. We're looking very frustrated that we kept talking about baseball. They're just like, stop talking about baseball already.
I just can't believe you don't know who Ross Wilson is.
Moving on to a sport that I actually do want to talk about. Let's talk a little bit about softball and the team's weekend series against Alabama as well. They swept a doubleheader Saturday, outscored them 19-2, absolutely destroyed them. You know, I said after that, like, this team is winning the Women's College World Series, no doubt. I went on the record with that. And then they came out Sunday, game three, and they dropped it 6-4. They tried to, they had a big seventh inning rally, but they fell a little bit short. Just didn't happen for them, but they, I mean, I want to say they looked a little rusty, which they did, some terrible fielding errors, which we'll get to a little bit later, but
is
I want to say...
Is rusty the right word, though?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's not like there was inactivity, so...
Just
sloppy.
Off. Yeah, just sloppy and off. I mean, Megan Bush had a couple errors. She only went down with one error on the record. I would say she had at least three or four bad plays.
I got your text about Megan Bush error machine, and it's definitely accurate. I feel like Megan Bush not a great fielder, so.
Yeah, she had a couple mistakes. Corey Brooks had the other error that they went down with on that in the game. But that one I want to mention because I was about to talk about the officiating. That error came after Corey Brooks technically made a triple play, and they called it back. They grounded out to her. She tagged the runner that was going home, stepped back onto the third base bag, threw it to first, triple play, right? They call it back. They say the ball was foul. Let's see if I can talk there for a second. The ball was foul, called the whole thing back. They came up on that next play. Corey Brooks got an error. They scored a run, and they went on to score three runs in that inning.
So that was a turning point for sure.
That was absolutely a turning point. And there were several of those. Like in the seventh inning, another bad call that went against Corey Brooks. She hit a ball that was at least 4 to 5, 6 inches within play. They called it foul. They had to go up. She ended up walking, so she ended up getting on a base. But it took some of the momentum away from the team.
What did Walton do in that situation? Because there were a couple of calls last year. He gets fired up.
So. This weekend was the most fired up I've seen him. He got in the ump's face several times. And, like, I mean, I could not blame him at all. There were some terrible calls, especially at the plate. Stacy was at the zone, was just everywhere. I mean, if you'd go by the ump there.
He's got a little Bobby Cox in him, that's for sure.
I like seeing him get fired up because, you know, he's asking his team to play, you know, passionately with some emotion. It helps that he's out there, you know, getting riled up.
There was another call you were telling me about a couple days ago that was really bad. Apparently someone on Alabama struck out to end the inning and everyone left the field, but then they came back on the umps, called it a foul ball. Can you explain that?
It was in Sunday's game. An Alabama player struck out against Stacy. You know, they called it a strikeout. All the Florida players were off the field. Alabama's players and coaches were still there. But, you know, the ump clearly called it strikeout. Inning was over. Everybody was off. Then the Alabama coach comes and talks to the ump. They share some words. I don't know what was said there. But then the ump undoes it, calls everybody back onto the field. And, you know, they play another two or three at-bats there. So.
That's really
okay, but wait, what you told me something that was completely perplexing to me. What did the umpire eventually say the ruling on that pitch was?
Oh, yeah, he called it a foul ball.
Okay, but the ball landed in the catcher's mitt after it was supposedly hit foul, right?
Yeah.
So that's still an out.
Yeah.
So even if he calls it a foul, it's still an out because it's a foul tip into the catcher's glove.
So what
did
he say? Hilbert's dropped it instead or something?
He's saying that. She didn't, but he said that.
Like, no, but she did not drop the ball.
No, absolutely not.
And the umpire... Did the umpire say she dropped it, or
no.
He was just like making up, okay, it's foul, let's just do it again?
Yeah, he just put his hands up in the air for foul ball.
So basically what you're telling me is the umpire does not know the rules of the game.
I mean, I feel safe saying that after watching Sunday's game.
Okay, so the umpire completely messed it up, even if it's a foul ball, and that's what he agreed on with the Alabama coach, it should have still been an out, a strikeout.
That's just one of many examples as to what happened this weekend.
Yeah, because you came into the office Sunday night after that game just hating on the officiating and saying, like, I know it's going to sound like bias, but, like, there's no way that those officials were any good on Sunday.
And like I said, I mean, Florida still made some mistakes of their own in the field, you know, which is what they said after the game. But you could tell from talking to him, you know, Walton didn't say anything about the officiating. His exact answer was...
He's not allowed to. That's the only reason.
His exact answer was, I'll be fine if I talk about that. But, and like Christina mentioned a little bit of that, Christina Hilberth, who I mentioned before, she, you know, said, we can't control the officiating. And then in a different question, completely unrelated, she said... Yeah, we had to deal with some adversity that we couldn't control the officiating. And, you know,
my favorite Walton story from covering the team last year was they were on a road trip and they lost to Long Beach State on a very controversial call that I didn't see because I only was watching it on Stat Tracker. But Asia Pakulva pulled Allie Gardner off the bag with a throw, allegedly, and let the winning run score in like the 10th inning. So when I got on the phone to talk to him, I asked him about the play and I asked him about the error Asia made. And he said, Asia didn't make an error. And I said, well, what happened then? And then he's like, well, she made the throw and nothing happened and the girl was out or something like that. And I was like, all right, but she was called safe, right? And then he's like, yeah, she was called safe. And I was like, well, so you clearly think they missed the call. And he's like, I'm not going to say that the officiating was terrible. I'm not going to say that I thought she was safe. And I'm not going to say that I thought they did a terrible job today or something like that. It was just a really good Walt story that kind of illustrates his personality. But yeah. You talked a lot about the errors, but, you know, I was watching the stat tracker for Saturday's games, and we hyped it as, like, the series to go watch, and they just straight beat them down in two straight games. So what was the environment like for those two games?
They said it was a record crowd. And I want to point out, we talked in a previous show about, you know, the numbers being made up or whatever. They actually had attendance counters to
prove the
record count of like 2,423 or something like that. Huge crowd. I've never seen it that crowded. More than the super regional games from what I understand.
I'm sure.
The place was absolutely insane. And they really fed off that, you know, 19-2 in those two games there. Although Walton did give credit to the music guy, as he called him, which you can see on our blog. Just check that out. But yeah, I want to go back to game three a little bit, because I don't feel like in the space we had in print we got to accurately describe exactly what happened in those last two innings, especially in the sixth, because that was an opportunity, you know, where things could have gone a different way but messed up there. I've mentioned before, Tiffany DeFelice was out, right? Had a wrist injury. She came back into this game to pinch hit. Came in just tons of energy, took the pitcher to a full count, cranked one to left, got on base. Alicia Cisco struck out, couldn't get anything going there. So they could have started the comeback then, maybe had a few fewer runs to come back from. And then in the seventh inning, the top of the lineup absolutely destroyed it at the beginning. Drew some walks, Kelsey Buter ripped a double down the right field line, Allie Gardner struck out, and then Francesca Ney took the first pitch she saw right out to the scoreboard. So at that point, everybody in the stadium was starting to believe, like, this could happen. Then the bad call I mentioned earlier with Corey Brooks down the foul line. Megan Bush walked. Christina Hilberth struck out on maybe one of the worst swings I've ever seen. It was like, she's a slap hitter, so she had the momentum going forward. And then she just kind of dropped her bat back. So that was obviously hurt. And then
dropped her bat?
Just like dropped it back in her arm. She just did not make the swing through.
I'm picturing like she just lets go of the bat.
Well, no.
She tried to bunt it?
Or was it toward the ball? Okay.
No, it was just, like she was confused as to what she was going to do. Maybe she thought she was supposed to take it. Things happen. But yeah, and then Moultrie came up, which you were able to read about in the story today, and hit that ball 5-6 feet away from, you know, a freshman having a game-winning home run and a series-sweeping home run. So that was really big for the team. I know, you know, they take losses hard. You know, this team has lost, what, 8 games in the last 2 years?
Eight now.
So, I mean, they don't take losing well. We'll see how they respond against Auburn Wednesday. Doubleheader starts at 5 p.m. our time. So.
I think 2 of 3 from Alabama is definitely a success for them, though. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, they were ranked number 2 in the country for most of the year, 4 coming into that game. So, yeah, I agree that it was a pretty big series win. So, yeah, we'll see how they respond to that. And I think that about wraps it up.
One more question. What did you think of Charlotte Morgan? Was she really disappointing this weekend?
She was incredibly disappointing this weekend, yeah.
We built her up, and now she let everyone down. Her numbers from last year, I don't know what she's doing this year, but her numbers from last year were just unbelievable. And she was very impressive in person, so I guess she didn't quite get it going. But Florida's got great pitching, so that'll do that to great hitters, I guess.
Yeah, Brittany Rogers, their leadoff hitter, was the one who really impressed me.
Yeah, she was an All-American last year. Kelly Montalvo, who's like 5 feet tall, plays third
base.
That's generous at 5 feet tall. Yeah, she's impressive, though, what she can do at her height. And Kelsey Dunn, also very good for them. So they're loaded.
She pitched 392 pitches this weekend, which is...
Did she pitch all 3 games?
No, she pitched the first and third.
And she threw 392 pitches in 2 games?
It was absurd. She pitched 181 in the first and then 211 in game 3.
What?
It was absurd. Like, Florida fouled off so many pitches, especially in those last 2 innings.
All right.
That is an incredible number.
Yeah.
211 pitches in a single game. Like, in baseball, like, there's no comparison. In baseball, if you throw 200 pitches, like, your arm is going to fall off. Oof. And...
funny you should say that, because part of the reason Florida came back against Alabama in Saturday night's game is because it seemed like such a blowout. So the Alabama coach left his pitcher out there, Adam Morgan, the guy's name is, to just finish out the game, like, kind of under all costs. And he went out there. You could tell he was really tiring. He pitched very well at the beginning of the game, but he didn't get yanked until he threw 138 pitches, which is an incredible number.
Yeah, that's unheard of. You'll never see pitchers in Major League.
And he's a freshman,
anymore.
Too. You don't want to kill your guy's arm like that. I know Sully, if somebody gets to 70, like, call it a night. So this kid went way too long, in my opinion. I think that's a bad coaching move. He was trying to save his bullpen, so.
Yeah.
But supposedly in softball, you can throw 1,000 pitches and it doesn't mean anything.
It's a much more natural motion, as they always like to say.
It's the leg, right?
What was that?
Use the legs in softball to pitch, not the arm.
Yeah, that's true. All right, I think that about wraps it up for today's show. We're going to move on here. We should have another show at the end of the week, so look to that and respond to our question that we asked in the last show, like what's the craziest Tebow hype moment you've seen? Deefer, you weren't here for that podcast. Do you have a craziest, an example of the most out of control you've seen the Tebow hype get?
I talked about this in a previous podcast, but Evan and I and Mike McCall were in the mall in Knoxville, Tennessee, and there were racks and racks of Tim Tebow jerseys, and I thought that was ridiculous.
That was insane. It wasn't just, you know, the store, they had them hidden away. It was when you walk in and you're staring straight ahead from the center of the store, you have three racks.
They were like on display. Come get your Tim Tebow jersey here. Like, there was more Tim Tebow jerseys. I think the Tennessee jersey was the Barry jersey, Eric Berry. So that's for what it's worth.
All right, there you have it. That's Mike DeFerdinando's most out of control Tim Tebow hype story. Respond with yours, send them to sports@alligator.org, or leave a comment on our blogs.
One more thing. Red Wings had two devastating losses this weekend to the Islanders, the worst team in the NHL, and also to the Predators, who scored 2 goals in 20 seconds on Sunday, but they're still second in the Western Conference, and the playoffs are guaranteed. So no worries there, Red Wings fans.
Yeah, all of you listening. No worries. You're all
three
cool.
Of you.
I just want to point out
that. There are three Red Wings fans listening. I am shocked if that's
the
case.
No, I'm in the world.
Oh.
Outside of Detroit.
I just want to point out that I was in the office with you when that 2 goals in 20 seconds happened. I don't know if I've ever seen Evan that angry. Like that, you were outraged. So.
And I wasn't watching the game on TV either. It was a game track. And I had minimized the window and I brought it back up like, what? This is unbelievable.
You can't get NHL games on TV for good reason. So.
It was on Versus that night?
It was not on Versus. No. Versus was showing some other counter programming to that.
Bull riding.
All right. Thanks for listening. And with that, we're out.